Buenos dias and good morning. Everybody good? Did we enjoy country drinks last night? Yeah? Down on the beach? Wasn't a bad place to be. So welcome to, let's see. The slides are moving, but they're not moving up on the screen. Let's try this again. There we go. Welcome to preparing your server roles and infrastructure for Windows Server 2003 end of support. My name's Joey Snow. I'm a senior technical evangelist with Microsoft. With me is my buddy Rick Claus.
Hello, Rick Claus, senior technical evangelist as well.
And what we're going to do is kind of walk you through upgrading your infrastructure, the various steps and things needed for Server 2003 end of support. So, out of curiosity and to know how we're along, I assume because you're in this room, you have some sort of Server 2003 infrastructure. Yes? Yes? How many of you have begun planning or started thinking about the end of life? Okay, how many of you have not started? Okay, that's an issue given the short time frame. Can anybody tell me the end of life date? Does anybody know? July 14th of next year, right? So what we're going to cover, start off talking about 2003 end of support, what it means, just to be very, very clear. Because what we have noticed in talking with a lot of customers, and Rick and I have the opportunity to talk to a lot of customers, is there's a lot of kind of confusion around exactly what that means. I think to begin with, it was pretty clear when we ran into Windows XP end of support last year, we weren't extending, right? And the same is holding true here as well. We're going to talk about the approach of migration. there's a lot of people are new into the industry or maybe have not gone through such a significant migration before. So we're going to talk about the approach that you take. And then we're going to step you through some common infrastructure workload upgrades, things like Active Directory, DNS. I'll talk a little bit about DHCP, and then we're going to spend some time talking about application upgrades and walk you through a sample scenario where we've got a web server load that we want to look at upgrading and migrating. And then talk a little bit about ongoing management, the fact that how do we manage using the tools that we're used to, and then give you some resources and next steps. The great thing is that I've been talking about the migration tools that have been built in since Windows Server 2008, from before that product actually shipped out. Rick then took a lot of that content and delivered it throughout the world as well.
I think the proper term is stole a lot of that content.
I believe that is that is the true term. So we've got a lot of experience. Between the two of us, I'd say we have 30-plus years of actual IT experience. I got my job by breaking everything possible. Actually, I hacked a WinINI file in Windows 3.1.1 when I worked in a call center so I could play solitaire. The IT guy said, wow, how did you figure that out? And offered me to take a course on Windows NT 3.1, Advanced Server. And that's how I jumped into IT. You jiggled a printer cable.
Yes, I was the guy that was crawling under the desks to get printers, HP 4Ls, to work once again. And just ended up being the guy that is, like you, sat down in front of the PC to do it. So definitely growing and going through the pains of most people, especially in the 2003 world.
Absolutely. Really, the goal of this session is to get you to understand that we have an opportunity here and an opportunity to innovate. And this has really been a big challenge as and I think it's been a theme of the week as I've been talking with various people. We had the opportunity to do Channel 9 Live, so live broadcast from TechEd here. Opportunity to talk to a lot of very senior Microsoft folks, some of the big speakers, Mark Rusinovich, Jason Zander. And I think it's a big theme of the event when we talk about the opportunity that lies ahead for IT and us having to adjust from a kind of break-fix world into a world of innovation in order to maintain things. We'll talk about this opportunity it is and how we can move forward. So as you can see, we have 257 days remaining on the countdown clock. Optimistic estimates says it takes about 200 days to do a server migration and 300 days to do an application migration. Unless, of course, you're running it in a demo environment, we can do it in less than 60 minutes.
Right. The biggest challenge that we've seen a lot is the people that have applications. The application workload is probably the most complex one to move because each vendor that has sold you that application generally is the one responsible for providing you with guidance on how to migrate it off. Because every application that they have is going to be unique with the way that it's installed, the dependencies, and also the versions of things. So we've come across a lot of people that have 2003 servers, they've got an application that's an in-house developed app, and they have a SQL Server 2005 installed on that box, and it's still running. And it really should not be running anymore once we get past July 14th.
Basically, this slide, if you don't have urgency today, particularly the few guys I saw at the back who raised their hand saying they hadn't thought, it's time for that urgency to come into play. Because end of support means no updates. 37 critical updates were released in 2013 for Server 2003 R2. That's pretty significant. I don't think we can turn on the news every day without seeing another breach, another issue. And a lot of times, these outages or breaches can be prevented because we've known where the vulnerability is and have provided a patch or an update to that. What you don't want to have occur is to put your business at risk because we are no longer supporting this outdated end-of-life system, and there's not a patch for a new vulnerability that has been discovered. It also means that it's not compliant. Do I have anybody in here who gets to deal with government regulations, compliance, payment cards, health care?
There's no government regulations in Europe. What are you talking about? EU doesn't do that sort of stuff.
A big piece is the PCI compliance. I happen to have the experience. I used to say I was lucky. After reviewing what I dealt with PCI compliance, I'm not sure I was lucky, but our company was the fifth company in the world to gain PCI compliance. It was not a pleasurable experience. Anybody who's dealt with that, I'm sure, can agree. But it would mean that you can't use Visa and MasterCard inside of your organizations. That's a big deal if you're doing payment. So it will not pass, Server 2003 will not pass a compliance audit. Now, I mentioned before that there is a lot of confusion. There's a lot of things coming out nowadays about, hey, I can just virtualize it and it will be okay. That's not true. A physical server, a virtual server, an operating system running in any of those environments is still an operating system running in that environment. So you cannot virtualize and get away with it. Regardless of what the competitors out there say, move it to our cloud and we will still run it for you. The end of the day, that underlying operating system is still non-compliant. We're not going to patch it and we're not going to update it. You're still running into the same problems and you're prolonging a problem and potentially accelerating impact as we move forward. Anybody in here running small business server? No?
Couple.
One guy? Okay, a couple people running small business server. This impacts you as well if you're running 2003. The reality is these older operating systems, and we've proven this out through various data, and you can read all the Gartner reports and all the things on this, actually increase operational support costs. It also can impact a business or the potential for new business. One of the companies that I used to work for and run IT for, I had an opportunity to visit about 8 months ago when I was at a conference. And I was talking to one of my old colleagues, and she was mentioning to me they had a very, very large potential contract. And the customer came on site to review things and to see the operation. And it was potentially millions of dollars worth of business. They then experienced an outage about 20 minutes after the customer arrived. That outage persisted over the course of 3 days. They didn't get the contract, as I'm sure you can imagine. The root cause analysis was related to an application running on server 2003. The server hadn't been updated and managed. It kind of fell through the cracks somehow. And it cost not only whatever impact that it had to the customers they already had and the business they were doing. It's a call center. If you're not taking phone calls, you don't make money. But it impacted a potential new contract. So there is truth to it takes more time to manage and deal with these older systems than it does to get current. And when you get current, you can then innovate. We have to move away from this mentality inside of IT as our careers progress of firefighting and just chasing the thing that's on fire. Right? That worked a while ago. That's not going to work now because the reality is they're not giving us money anymore in IT, right? I mean, does anybody have the unlimited budget or the big budgets we used to have? One guy has a bunch of budget. Are you the manager? But the reality is our budgets are decreasing. But what's happening at the same time? The demands on us are increasing, right? So less budget, but people want to be able to access the tools, not just from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., but they want to be able to do it when they're on an airplane. They want to be able to do it late at night. And when things don't work at 2 o'clock in the morning, your phone is ringing, right? So we have to deal with that increased operational cost. And the reality is as well, this means that we're going to lose support for applications. And I know there are a lot of verticals that I speak to in the oil and gas industry, financial, healthcare. Financial, not so much anymore. Things tend to progress because of regulation. But where there is an application, it is the application that supports the business. It's been running for 10 years on the same platform. We as IT don't want to touch it because we don't want to break it, right? But as we move forward, you've never upgraded that application. Well, with end of support of the underlying operating system, most of our software vendors stop supporting those systems as well. So something to be aware of. So basically now it's time to act. Actually, it was time to act a year ago when we made the announcement. But we all know in IT, time is something we never have. And as I mentioned, those lead times, 200 to 350 plus days to actually get a migration project off the ground, running and completed, something that we need to seriously think about. That's why we're here again talking about migration and upgrading. So start planning. Anything to add?
No, that's good. I think it's a good transition to the migration approach. I mean, this is a very sound way to kind of discuss what you should do. It's basic principles to go through. And we're going to go through some of these steps. We're also fast-tracking this, obviously, for the demos that are coming up here. We never recommend you try to do an upgrade in as fast of a time as we're going to do one. But obviously, you probably should have already started your discovery phase and doing some assessments and views and analysis of what type of applications you have up and running. And then once you've done that discovery phase, you go through and do an assessment of what is actually critical to maintain and what is okay to let go by the wayside. It is okay to potentially talk about it's not worth upgrading or migrating that workload off the system because there's a newer version available for purchase and it's time to do an upgrade and replacement of that data to a supported platform from those different vendors. So we have to go through an assessment phase to determine if it makes sense to do an upgrade or a migration, or if it just makes sense to cut our losses and to move. And obviously that's going to be a hard conversation that you have to have with the business.
I've had several customer examples that I've been in briefings with that we've really had to sit down. This isn't an easy conversation to have. People are used to the things that they're running with. Getting end users trained up on newer software is not the easiest thing as well. Potential cost involved there, but that cost is pretty insignificant if you compare it to the potential risk or loss of revenue that you may have by having an older system. So being able to understand and catalog, is anybody new to an organization where you really don't know what you have in the environment or the infrastructure is very, very big? So there's a number of tools that we have to help and assist, right, in terms of this. So I'm going to show you, let's see, I have to move this guy over here.
Yeah.
So I'm going to show you. This is a website. We put the link inside of the slide deck, so you'll be able to visit this website here. This is the Server 2003 end of support main page. At the bottom, you'll have the countdown timer. You can, of course, set that up in the upper right-hand corner of your boss's monitor, right? So at all times, it's ticking down so that he understands why your head's down working on this stuff. But it basically kind of goes through these steps, and it will walk you through. So you're not just relying upon a slide deck from a couple of guys from North America from TechEd. But it's pretty cool. We have the Migration Planning Assistant, and I actually really do like this portion of the website. So basically, what we have is the ability to actually go through and give you the access to the tools that you'll need to do assessment and planning. It can be anything from the Microsoft Assessment and Planning Toolkit or the MAP tool. Anybody use that tool? It's been around for a long time. I'm a big fan of the MAP tool. I used that when I was doing a little bit of consulting before I joined Microsoft. And then I actually had taken a new job managing a brand new infrastructure. The previous administrator basically walked out the door, changing the passwords of everything and causing a little bit of a problem beforehand. But when I had to take that role, I had to figure out what was actually in the infrastructure because he was the main guy. Everybody else was desktop support guys. Nobody managed the server infrastructure on the back end. So I used that MAP tool to kind of figure out and get a good idea of what was actually out there. There are partner offerings or partners that you can that we have available that can help with this and assist in this migration effort as well. And then we have done the Jumpstart is. Has anybody visited the Microsoft Virtual Academy or visited a Jumpstart before? So it's an online 4 to 8 hours worth of training. The recording from the Jumpstart. Now, did you do this Jumpstart or?
I honestly forget. I've done so many of them.
We've done this so many times, and we've done a bunch of Jumpstarts and things that we actually have a Jumpstart. It goes into a lot more detail than we're able to cover in 75 minutes because you've got hours. But we kind of walk through those things, and we put the link right there. On this website to go back and view that. But if you already know what's running, we can go ahead and click the next link, and it's going to kind of give us some ideas of what we need to do. We can actually select through the roles. I don't want to spend too much time on this because we're going to go through a lot of these things, right? So I'm going to deselect a couple of these guys here because these are the things that we're really going to kind of focus on today. Our Windows Server roles. Do we have Microsoft-based applications? Do we have SQL Server? Do we have Exchange Server? Do we have SharePoint or some other workload running on top of it? My guess is the reason that you're still running a 2003 server is that there's probably some workload running on top of it that doesn't run on a newer version, correct? Or are we running newer versions on top of the old OS? Maybe it's a server that just keeps getting upgraded and upgraded and upgraded in terms of hardware, but the OS stays the same. There's all sorts of scenarios. I've seen everything in this world around this. So we can choose those applications. Maybe you have a custom-built application, inside, internal line of business application. A guy wrote it 15 years ago, took off to the Bahamas, bought an island. You've never seen him since, right? Those types of scenarios. I'm using extreme examples, but hopefully you'll get the point there. And then, of course, any of our partner or third-party applications. So when you continue on, you can actually see migration targets. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that as we kind of jump into the demos and talk about our targeting. But there's a lot of different offerings and different methods. Now, to be clear on this, there are options to leverage cloud. When I speak cloud, cloud does not mean somewhere else. In other words, cloud is not aware. Cloud is a how. So the approach can be via private cloud. The approach could be via a hosted cloud environment, or it could be through a public cloud provider like Microsoft Azure, right? You can upgrade on top of an existing infrastructure, leveraging the new storage technology, leveraging the features that we have in Server 2012 R2. You can use virtual machines to upgrade. In fact, Rick's going to go through a pretty cool scenario that we have there. It's kind of my preferred method as well. It's okay to have domain controllers on VMs now, right?
I was just going to say, provided that that hypervisor is Hyper-V or the latest version of VMware. You have to have the most recent versions of things.
And then, of course, we can always go old school the way it's been, hardware, right? Buy a new server, let's get that on there. And then as you continue along, oh, let's see, what are we going to do? We're going to do it on new hardware for the file server, on the web server. We're just going to move it to the cloud. And then Active Directory, we're going to do that in a virtual machine. And if I click continue, and we'll choose a region, I'm going to choose my region. And then you can select a bunch of information, get a bunch of kind of tell us where you're from. And then you're going to get basically the steps that we're going to talk about today. Now I need to get back to the slides. Hey, look, I did it right. So as we mentioned, the way I think about migration, the way I break up the project, is that we're going to look at our core infrastructure first, the things that keep the lights on, those critical services. Businesses typically don't run well without DHCP and DNS, right? Active Directory, if you're using Active Directory for authentication, those are those core services that we need. And then we'll go and kind of start digging in further, print servers, terminal servers, those kinds of things. And then approach applications, because without that core infrastructure started and that underlying foundation that we run our IT infrastructure on, it's kind of tough to start looking at applications. But then we'll break down into applications. So when we talk about our core infrastructure services, you'll notice that underneath I have migration here, because we typically will migrate, not upgrade. I'll talk about that for a reason, but applications can be upgraded and typically are. Here is something also to be aware, and I hope everybody in this room is aware of this, but with Server 2008 R2, we stopped shipping 32-bit server operating systems, meaning that Server 2012, Server 2012 R2, they're 64-bit, right? 32-bit applications can run on 64-bit infrastructure. To be clear, right? While 64 is a great thing, it's a great way to run 32-bit apps on 64-bit servers. We are probably doing that on your laptops today. I know I am, because I'm running Windows 8, 64-bit on my laptop, but I'm running a 32-bit version of Office. So, as we mentioned before, a couple of different ways to get there. Physically, new hardware. Virtually, through Hyper-V or another product, preferred Hyper-V. Obviously, I'm wearing the blue shirt, right? Or also, we can actually run infrastructure services in Azure, if you're looking at Microsoft Azure, through the use of infrastructure as a service or a virtual machine that's running up in Azure. And actually, I'm running some of these services I'm going to show you today up there as well. And you can connect the two infrastructures. I don't want to turn this into an Azure talk. Azure is one of my passions, has been since it first came out. And I asked my boss, I made a mistake. When we announced Azure, I believe it was the PDC. I don't remember what year it was. I said, so what is the impact on IT? And how do we tell that story? And my boss says, go figure it out. Because it was a developer story then. So I've kind of been hooked on it as well. So the migration of foundational services, we're going to go through and talk about Active Directory, DNS. We're actually going to show this to you and then get into some of the other roles. And that's really where we want to focus today. We really, really want to focus on those foundational services. We're not going to spend a ton of time on apps. We'll talk about it. So why not upgrade? I'm going to ask the question, has anybody here gone in and put media via USB? Or we're talking about 2003 here, so probably a CD. And actually upgraded a server, where you put in the disk and you upgrade the OS? It's not typical. Because inside of the IT process, if I'm not incorrect, the way my experience tells me is, we only update the operating system when we buy a new piece of hardware, correct? Yes? Yeah, that's typically when it occurs. Why? Well, because we can't buy the old one. So we're buying the new operating system, and we're getting a bunch of licenses, and we're just going to put the newest, latest, and greatest on there. And then, of course, we as IT guys, being the resourceful guys as we are, if I'm not incorrect, you take the old thing and you put it into a lab or use that to upgrade something that was even older, right? Or migrate it into something older. Reality is, and it's, if you've been in IT any length of time, you know, clean operating systems work best, right? Particularly in these older OSs. The great thing about migration is it significantly reduces any risk that you have or impact into the business because you always have the old thing to fall back on. And I'm kind of one of these, you know, what is the term? Measure twice, cut once. I always say measure once, cut twice. But it significantly reduces your downtime. You still have the active environment. You can get everything set up into the background before you actually, quote unquote, flip the switch. It also gives you time to do what I call user acceptance testing. In other words, you stand up an infrastructure, you move a set of some of your best users, or in my case, I tend to pick some of the most difficult users and put them on there because they yell the loudest and they're gonna find the problems before, you know, some of my super sharp technical guys. They're just gonna go, there was a glitch, I don't need to tell them about it, versus the person who's very difficult, who's calling you every day because they can't print an email, right? And as I mentioned, there's always the way to kind of back out. So this is the scenario that we're going to be talking about today and kind of a picture of the world that we're living in. We've got a domain infrastructure running on Server 2003. There's some file and print services, little domain controllers. We've got clients that he's working with. We've got printers that we have to deal with. And actually, we have two file and print servers on here. One of them is supposed to be a web server as well. Got a web server workload. That web server is front-ended by IIS, and on the back-end infrastructure, it's running SQL. And we're going to talk about how we're dealing with that as well. So to do this, I don't know how many of you are aware of this, but inside of Server 2008, we released a set of migration tools. These migration tools are fully documented, PowerShell-driven tools, that once we got to Server 2012 became a part of the operating system. They're there for use. They work on down-level OSs down to 2003. And there's a few notes that we can call out on these tools. Obviously, you need to have disk space. It's kind of funny, I put this slide up, I get chuckles in the room when people see 23 meg. Have you looked at the free space on your old servers? Right? There's not a lot of storage space on some of these old devices. .NET Framework version 2. Be surprised the amount of servers I've seen out there that don't have anything. And then PowerShell 1.0. One of my favorite things about these tools as I mentioned, we have full documentation on TechNet about the tools, right? And what they are. And you'll see exactly what you need to have in order to move from particular source servers, so infrastructure, so we're talking about 32-bit OS to a 64-bit OS, what the requirements are if they're x86, x64, the things that you'll need to have. And then we'll go into kind of more depth about these migration commandlets. They are commandlets run inside of PowerShell. I've been talking PowerShell for a long time. They really are extremely powerful tools. And then as we start to dive deep into each one of these services, we go through from start to finish documentation on what to do before, during, and post-installation of all the major functionalities and roles. Active Directory, DHCP, DNS, terminal services, print servers, file servers, web servers. It says, these are the steps that you need to take beforehand. Okay, we're good to go. Let's start the migration. It'll say, here are a few things to test. And then it'll say, post-migration, these are the steps to decommission the old device. And these tools have been around for a very, very long time. Right? Rick, why don't you kind of go through starting and talking about the installation of these tools. Let's get into some demo.
Get them into some demo mode of stuff. So first off, you have to choose the migration tools from the version of the server that you are migrating to. We're going to be migrating stuff to server 2012 R2, so that's where I have to install the tools. Pretty simple. The way you do that is simply going into Server Manager, going into Manage, Add Roles and Features. In this case, it is actually a feature that I want to install. And in order to save time, I have already installed the tools.
They're grayed out.
I know, because they're already there. Perfect. Yep. So server migration and tools, they're basically already installed, ready to go. And all that means is they are installed and available on my local hard drive. Once that's done, cancel that out, because you guys don't want to see a program going through. I'm just going to go over here and create a package.
So what Rick is doing here is the tools are actually part of the OS. They're part inside. They live within inside of Server 2008, Server 2012. But what we have to do is we have to prepare a package that we're going to run and install on our down-level servers. So you can create a package for an x86 down-level server or an x64 down-level server if you have one, if you were one of the guys that jumped on the 64-bit bandwagon in 2003.
So you can see here, basically, the utility is called smigdeploy.exe. I do a slash package to say create me an installation package. I choose an architecture, which is the same as my source architecture. So it's an x86, 32-bit. I choose my operating system. The operating system is Windows Server 03. I choose a path where I want them to actually go off and install, and go ahead and execute that.
So smigdeploy, smig stands for server migration. So most of the commandlets are going to be smig server or smig something or other. So it's pretty simple to understand the PowerShell language that we have here.
So if I go over here, I just made a directory structure. It's called migration. And you can see here that the tools are available. And there we go. I've got a file folder structure. It's called SMT, Server Migration Tools 03x86. That's what I want to use. So if I go over here and attach up to my Server 2003 box, you can see over here is 2003 R2 domain controller. I'm going to go over here, take those tools, copy them down to my local hard drive. Gotta love the lag I'm getting. And paste it. And then I'm going to go off and start a command prompt, make it so you guys can see it.
One of the fun things about going back and playing in 2003 after using the more modern OSs, 2008 and 2012, is just trying to figure out how you used to do everything. You click the button and you start typing. Oh, wait, I have to click run first before I can type in that command, right? It's always like going back in time.
Now this time when I'm doing this, I'm just going to go ahead and run the same command, smigdeploy, but this time I'm not going to bother doing a slash package. I'm just instead going to go off and run smigdeploy. And that will go off and install the tools and then open up a PowerShell prompt because I met all my prerequisites. And again, because it was a brand new PowerShell prompt that did not exist before, I have to change the size of the font so you guys can see it. But now, basically, I have my migration tools there and ready to go. Now, you can use these migration tools for a large variety of migration of objects and things. For instance, migrating DHCP, migrating file servers. We're going to use it just as here's the example of how to get the tools in place. We're not going to use them for Active Directory. We're just going to do a shift and lift type implementation for Active Directory. But basically, this guy here is ready to go. I could use him for the one that I like the most, which is local group recreation. So basically, I can go in, and if I have local groups that have permissions assigned to a file server on that local box, it's 2003, I can have those local groups created on my destination server as part of the migration process, and when I migrate the files, they will already have the appropriate groups, and therefore the ACLs and the security settings will just naturally merge right in.
This is pretty beneficial if you've done a delegation of various administrative roles and activities. I went through a project where I migrated DHCP from 65 servers down to 4 servers when we consolidated our infrastructure. And we were using separate DHCP administrators or local server administrators. You can't just copy the local administrators group, right, and all of its membership. What this tool does is it will look and see if the group exists. If it doesn't, it will recreate it, and then it will populate all of those groups. And it will scan and it will say, hey, look, on our source server, I have these five user accounts, or group accounts, hopefully, depending on if you follow the you know, method of account into a global group, into a local group, assign the permissions, or inside, your delegation to. But it'll look and scan. So it won't actually take the local administrator's group from your source server, because it already exists. And that breaks the way SIDs work. So some tools used to do that. It used to try to copy it, and it would break SIDs. So what this does is it actually goes and it says anything that's built in, and you'll see this when you look through the logs of the tool, any built-in group or account that already exists on the server, it says, I'm ignoring it because it's already there. Oh, but look, inside of this built-in group, I've got membership. Let's make sure that we populate that. So it's a really great way to just, as you, I think you use the term lift and shift, just pick it up and move it. Because sometimes when we do these migration projects, we're up against a timeline like we are today, where it's like, we just need to get off. Granted, 2 years ago when we first, or a year and a half ago when we first heard about this end of life thing, we're like, hey, let's use this as an opportunity to clean out all that membership and do all of those things. You might not be in that position to accomplish that. So you can then just basically have that replica right there, all the membership that you need and everything else.
Should I start the Active Directory or let you do a couple slides first?
Let's just jump right into Active Directory.
Okay.
So we're going to move some AD.
Yeah. So for this, basically, in case you don't know, you're able to take a 2012 R2 member server that's part of the 2003 domain. Once it's a member server inside that domain, and obviously pointing to the proper domain controller for authentication, you're able to go through and run the good old-fashioned DCPromo. DCPromo is no longer a command line tool in 2012 R2. It's now actually a wizard interface. So you can see up here, I've already gone ahead and installed the binaries for this, and that's why I have this lovely little exclamation mark next to my flag to say, hey, go ahead and run this. So again, to speed things up, I've gone ahead and loaded the binaries for domain controller on this box. And if you're familiar with the types of things that you would normally put into a DCPromo command line, we're basically going to go ahead and do this using a wizard interface. But with this wizard interface, it's going to go ahead and pre-populate a lot of stuff, and it's also going to fix the proper default settings, if you will, because it the default settings actually used to be new domain in a new forest as opposed to an additional domain controller in an existing domain.
So you've got to love it how the default from before was something that you do in an organization maybe once or twice. Right, versus adding additional domain controls. You only create a forest one time, usually. Right? You only create domains on occasion, but that was the default. We fixed that here.
So the neat thing about this particular deployment tool is that it's also going to go off and make sure that I meet all the prerequisites as it goes through. So it just basically checked to say, did that user account that was used have the proper rights for scheme admins and also enterprise admins? Because I have to obviously update the schema. I cannot actually choose to make this guy a read-only domain controller. That's an advanced function that I have to have a more up-to-date Active Directory in place to be able to do. So I'm going to make this guy have DNS on me, and I'm going to make him into a global catalog, and I'm going to put in a directory services repair mode password.
One of the things that I want to be clear about, when we first started talking about Active Directory in Windows 2000, we kind of scared everybody into never, ever, 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 ever change the schema and only modify the schema when absolutely necessary because things go poorly. That was kind of bad on our part. Schema modifications are a part of life now, and having to update your schema is a big part of this upgrade process. So this is the first assessment that you're going to make. You're going to have to look at any internal applications that may have potentially modified the schema that may need to come over, and this is a great about doing this in a virtual environment, is that you can stand this up, and you can then test against it to see, are we going to run into any problems when we're doing this migration off of 2003 Active Directory?
Well, I highlighted two options here because these are more advanced options. Same thing if you did DCPromo/ADV. You cannot install and start your replication from an existing backup system state. because you have to have the same version of the system state backed up of the operating system. So we don't have a 2012 R2 domain controller, so I can't use that. And so therefore, I have to choose which domain controller I want to replicate from. I'm just leaving the defaults there. And then asking me, obviously, where you want to put the database files, the log files, and sysvol. And this was a real domain controller. I would be concerned about separating those off onto dedicated disks to get better performance. Also to make sure that I don't run out of space, because some 2003 servers used to have 80 gigabyte partitions as the default install, or 40 gigabyte partitions.
Ours was 65.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it goes through and basically looks at my answers to say what's going to go on. It's all good. And then hit next to go off and start it. It's going to start the prerequisites check and then basically go off and take a look at it. So here you can see it's verifying the prerequisites for the domain controller operation. It's going to determine that the schema needs to be updated. It's going to do a schema prep and also domain prep as well. But it's going to do that for me automatically. And again, if I was using a user account that did not have the proper rights, it would tell me here. Now, it's also warning me here that potentially the default security setting for cryptography algorithms for establishing sessions for 2012 basically got more elevated, and it warns that if you have any legacy applications that still use NTLM, that they might no longer work. So be aware of that. It also warns me that I cannot find DNS because this is a lab environment and it's isolated, so that's just normal. And then I'm going to let it go ahead and go. You can see there it's upgrading the forest.
So this again, a little bit different than how we used to do it with 2003 and early versions of 2008, where we're having to do manual forest prep and domain preps and schema updates. This is part of the upgrade process, which is a big part of why you chose not to use an upgrade tool and just go ahead and use Active Directory's built-in functionality to do DC promo.
Now, we did a session in TechEd North America, it's available online for recording, that talks about how to recreate your domain environment inside a lab environment as written by Premier Support engineers. Mark, great guy, went ahead, basically wrote this all out. I would obviously recommend you review that session because you're going to want to have as close to a real environment as possible to be able to go ahead and test this rather than just simply going through the motions like I'm going through right now.
Yeah, it's really cool because what we do is we actually take a backup and we go through the process of taking that backup and basically recreating our environment. It's an exact replica, but it's offline and completely disconnected, right? And it is a fairly short process to actually get it done.
Yep, so I believe we have the reference information for that.
Yes.
On here as well. This is gonna take a little bit of time. I can monitor this if you wanted to.
Sure, absolutely.
I'm pretty sure they don't wanna sit here and watch.
You guys wanna watch progress bars? Oh wait, that's what we do when we're in the office, right?
That's multitask.
That's multitasking.
So I'll let this guy go ahead and finish off and then let him do the first reboot and then come on up afterwards.
So while that's going, I'm just going to do a quick run out to the TechNet portal here if we wanted to. I mentioned before these migration tools having that before, during, after guidance. And you'll see there's the link there.
Do the survey, man.
Should I do this? Let's do the survey right in the middle of our session. But you'll see, the great thing about this is that this team has actually extended. It used to be, there when this product originally shipped and our migration tool shipped, we only had six different roles or services that we can migrate. They continue to innovate in this and move them on. So it's fantastic. I mentioned my DHCP migration project. When I took this on, anybody remember the resource kits? Do I have anybody who's old school like me loves resource kits, right?
Big thick book?
Yeah, the CD. I kept those CDs. They were like gold, right? Every version of the next one that came out, I'm like, we can't lose this because they don't make it anymore. Well, there was a resource kit tool called DHCP EXIM or EXIM. Anybody use that awesome tool to do DHCP migration? It's awesome, isn't it? We were using this in my migration project to move DHCP, and we found on average that tool caused us about 15% loss of active DHCP leases from the servers. Not a big deal to get a new lease on a machine, is it? No, other than it involves either logging in as administrator or having the user reboot the machine. In a call center environment, that's not something that you can do. Users have to be on the PCs. They have to be taking phone calls. When you work in a 24/7 environment, you can see the challenge that we had with losing that percentage. But what I love about this tool for DHCP migration, and I'm just going to quickly just talk through this real quick. This is exactly what I was stating. We go through all of the processes. Here are the exact things that you need to do in the exact steps. It tells you the exact permissioning that you're going to need to do. Or if you're going to delegate this to Johnny, the junior server admin, to get some knowledge and skills, what he will need to have. But you'll see, as we mentioned, we've installed the migration tools. We're going to use PowerShell. We're going to prep the destination server, everything that we need to do. You'll see that what we're actually going to do migrating the DHCP server. So we're going to stop the service. We're going to make sure that we have the PowerShell running. And then you'll see here we've got this export SMIG server setting. So export server migration settings, DHCP. We're going to want to move all of our users in our groups. Why would we move users in groups for DHCP? It's this little one called DHCP admins, right? Remember, we used to break all of this stuff up. We still do. A lot of people had separate DHCP administrators away from DNS administrators because back in the day, a lot of people were still running older DNS, or their DNS guys were old Linux guys or Unix guys, and they only let us have our one Windows-based DNS server so that we could run Active Directory. Anybody live that world? Yes? So we're going to want to move those, and then we're also going to want to move the IP configuration of the DHCP server. This is a good thing because we can actually do that little shift. Instead of just bringing up a new server, which you can do, we want to shift this around so that we don't lose our active leases and that the clients know it never changed. It's like nothing ever happened to them. And then what we're going to do is we actually pick up the database. And we pick up this database and we store it in a temporary location, a temporary file, a file share, right? It's encrypted. You can encrypt it with a password. And then we connect from our destination server. And we do, instead of export SMIG server setting, we do import SMIG server setting, DHCP, give it groups and all the things that we have there. And it reads that database file, and it pulls all of that stuff in. So everything, every reservation, every active lease, every option that you have in DHCP, the one for your IP phones, the one for some crazy device that somebody up on the 14th floor has, those all come in because it's an exact copy, unlike the previous tool, which was like, well, we're kind of backing up the database and kind of not, and we're kind of restoring it, but not really because we're making these changes. It's actually an exact copy, so everything moves along. And then once we finish this, you'll see, this is what I love about this. There's a verification step, all of the things that you may want to do. Obviously, to verify DHCP is working, IP config, pretty simple tool that we have. And then once we are finished there, here are the post tasks that you need to do to complete it, right? Retiring the old server, making sure that your source server is all offline and everything there. We good?
The box, by the way, just finished replicating, upgrading the domain, upgrading the forest, and is now in the middle of the first reboot. It's now coming up after post, and then I should be able to show them the FSMO role transfer in just a second.
The other thing, too, that this tool also gives you is estimated time for completion. So it's a good way as you go through your planning phases to actually go through and put that plan together and know, okay, this might take X amount of time in our case, and we want to be prepared for that. Because I don't know how many of you live, did anybody in here live in maintenance windows, right, where you have to submit, and this is what I love, is you submit what changes you want, and it's reviewed by business, who's never done IT, right, yeah? No, I'm sorry, you can't upgrade that server. We don't care that it's going to cost the business $2.5 million. We don't want it down, right? That's kind of the reality of it. So it's a great way to kind of go through this. Are there any questions about these tools in PowerShell and the requirements that we have? So it's pretty much open. It's pretty simple. The only issues I've ever run into with customers is just not having enough disk space. So it's one of those things, that 24 meg, it's amazing how hard it is to find 24 meg on some of these older servers. So back over.
I'm going to speed up this demo.
Okay.
I'm going to jump ahead a bit and look at the clock there.
All righty. Let's jump over to my slides. All right, so what basically Rick showed you, we've installed our features. We made the installation package for our migration tools. We then copied that over to the 2003 server. We've executed SMIG deploy on our 2003 server and done the installation. That's it. It's pretty simple what he showed you there. He then started migrating our Active Directory. When we migrate our Active Directory, you need to ensure that your forest functional mode, easy for me to say, is at least 2003. It's interesting. I've been involved in customer situations where they're running 2003 domain controllers, but their forest and domain functional modes are lower. So that's going to be that first step that you have to take, is updating those forest functional modes, which means you got to get rid of those Windows 2000 and Windows NT servers that have already gone end of support. Promote a Windows Server 2012 R2 box to a domain controller, allow it to replicate. And then the next step that Rick is going to has already done over here to speed us up is to transfer the FSMA roles, or the flexible single master of operation roles.
You got it.
Then once that's done, you've got a 2012 domain controller, and we just go through the steps like we do any other domain controller when we move it out. DC promo, demote it down. And then, once that's demoted, and once all of your other domain controllers are demoted, you can then set the forest functional levels to wherever you need them in your business, 2008, 2012, 2012 R2, wherever it is that you're moving to.
Okay.
There you go.
Okay, so again, to speed this up a bit, because I want to make sure we get through everything, you obviously have to let replication come to a convergence level across the different domain controllers. We don't have the time to wait for that in this particular environment because of our pressed for time nature of doing this in 75 minutes. So let's pretend that I did wait for that. When I did wait for that, the next thing you would do is obviously transfer the FSMA roles. You can transfer FSMA roles using the old-fashioned way of doing that with NTDS util, which is fun. Or you can use our 2012 R2 PowerShell commandlets. Now, I've already done this, so I just want to show you what the commandlets were. So basically, you're able to find out where the FSMA roles happen to be for domain-wide ones, and then the ones that are forest-wide. Forest-wide and domain-wide. So you can basically run this command on both of those. Now, this would have returned back that they were all sitting on 2003, but I've already gone ahead and moved them. And so you can do that now with one command. That's called Active Directory Server Operations Master Role. Identify the name of the server that you want it to go to, and then the role that you want to move. And you can see here that I just take them all, basically. Operations Master Role. I want the Domain Naming Master, the Schema Master, the PDC Emulator, the RID Master, the Infrastructure Master, and basically that's it. So all five of them. As opposed to having to do NTDS util connect to server, go back a level, and then transfer one, transfer two, transfer three, wait for them all to replicate. I've basically done that to speed this up.
And PowerShell is great, and you can get this information just by doing a get-help.
Right. Now, one thing that's very important is obviously you want to go ahead and get rid of your other 2003 domain controllers. So let's say you have four or five other domain controllers that are out there, and you want to get rid of them. One thing you can look at doing is virtualizing your domain controllers, like this guy is, and you can actually clone your domain controllers. Cloning your domain controller is not as crazy as it sounds. It's actually the fastest way to get a new domain controller up and running 2012 R2 in a virtualized world. And so what I thought I'd do is I'd show you guys what it looks like to do a clone. What you first of all have to do is obviously have a 2012 R2 domain controller up and running, like I do right here.
Yeah, so all the other ones can still be 2003.
So yeah, you can stay in this state for a while once you get rid of your last 2003 domain controller by doing clones and then deploys. to make it faster, because you saw how long it took to do the first one.
Yeah.
You can basically go ahead and promote the domain controllers down, get rid of them, and then you can go and raise your forest level and raise your domain levels up to 2012 R2 to take advantage of things like Active Directory Recycle Bin and flexible single password setting objects and things like that for multiple password policies. So I've got a Active Directory Users and Computers. There is a new group that is called, I always forget where they put it. Where was it? Clonable Domain Controllers. There it is. So there is a new group that's created in 2012 R2 that's called Clonable Domain Controllers. You basically have to put in the name of the server that is, so choose computers, going to be used as your source. This is a safety mechanism to make it so no one just starts to go and clone your domain controllers, right? That would not be a good thing.
So what we're doing is we're saying this server, this first server, is the source server for all the rest of our clones.
Right.
And only this server.
Right. It's not anyone. It's this particular one that I'm using. And again, I'm choosing this one just because it's a demo environment, and I'm using one of them to be able to go get it done. So once you've done that once, added them to the group, you then are able to go ahead and do some little PowerShell here. And you have to, first of all, check to see what applications that are running on this particular server are not compatible with a cloned new system coming up. So some of them are not. You can have a little command line here to run this, and basically it's going to go off and analyze what's there, and then take a look at it, and then come back with a report. In this case, I have one ASP.NET service that's up and running, and they don't recommend that I do this. Because this is a demo environment, I'm not actually using that ASP.NET service, I'm going to go ahead and proceed. So what you have to do is then go ahead and generate a new excluded application list, including that particular application, to say that it's okay. So that's the PowerShell command line to do that one.
So if this was one of these cases that I had an application that I actually need to run on that domain controller, either right. I have to move it or I have to find another domain controller.
Right. Okay. Or if you're doing this in your lab environment, you're going to clone it anyway, see if it works, and then continue to use it.
There you go.
Right? Next up, you got to go in and create this file. It's called cloneconfig.xml file. And luckily, it'll go through, and there's a PowerShell commandlet to do this. And if I take a look at this, it says basically, what's the new name going to be of this clone, DC02? What site is it going to belong to, default first site name? What kind of IP address is it going to have? A static address, and it's going to be .41 for an address. Subnet mask, default gateway, and then DNS. Why does it need to have a DNS server? Why does it need to have IP address that's working and all sort of stuff?
Well, you know, DNS is only a core.
It's core tenant to how service works.
Directory,
and so basically
right?
It needs to know, how can I query DNS and find my PDC emulator? How can I find my other domain controllers? So I have to basically include that inside my environment. And then if I go take a look at this, I even have a preferred Win server just because I like to put Win stuff in there.
Well, I mean, we are replacing 2003 servers, so Win's may be something that you have to address with some of those applications prior to moving those applications, because as I mentioned, core infrastructure goes before apps.
So this bit went by really fast. What I want to show you is, if I scroll back on this list, it was all basically green with one yellow, which simply said that, hey, there's an exclusion list here, and therefore you're taking responsibility that this thing is going to work. And it also checked to make sure that I belong to that group. So if I didn't add the server into that group, it wouldn't allow me to make this individual clone. So that's basically good.
And, now, and like everything, you would need to be a domain admin to add that server to that group, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And it tells me that it's going to actually stick this file inside the NTDS utility or directory structure. So the neat thing about this is when you clone a domain controller, it's assuming that you're obviously going to be virtualized. So what's going to happen is if it detects on the hypervisor host that it is a exported and re-imported machine, it's going to have a new virtual machine ID. In 2012 and 2012 R2, we have a new bit that is called the VM Gen ID. VM Gen ID, which basically tells the domain controller, hey, you're a clone, or you are coming up as a new machine that used to be something else. It used to be a domain controller. Because you're coming up as a new VM ID, we're going to pause what we're doing, read this clone config file, change the computer name, set the IP address, and then boot this thing up when it's done. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to go back to my hypervisor on this guy right here. And like anything, I would simply go over here and I would say export. Give it a name. I'm just going to put it inside volume one export here.
Good, create the folder.
Yeah, I know. Pain. Export. You think it'd be smart enough just to do it, of course, but no, it's not. Hit the export button, and then this is going to go ahead and start the export process. So basically, it's copying the VHD files and bringing it across and making sure everything's all happy. Now, again, the magic of demos. I've already gone ahead and done this export. I'm not going to wait for it to finish. I'm going to go ahead here and simply say import a virtual machine. So you guys had already seen that virtual machine that was imported. So here, clustered storage, volume, VMs, exports, and there it is. That's the guy I want to bring in. And here's the trick. I'm going to see if I, yes, I did remember zoom it here. Register the virtual machine in place. That's not what you want to do. Restore it with the existing VM. It's not what I want to do. I want to go ahead and copy it to a new location. The reason why is because I want to deploy this to another hypervisor someplace to be able to do it. Because this is a demo, I am going to leave it in the same spot. And I'm going to store it in a different location. And I'm just going to go ahead, take the defaults where they need to reside. It's going to give me a summary, hit finish, and it's going to go ahead and copy these individual files. Again, you'll see this go by. This unfortunately is something I do have to wait for. What you will notice is that I will end up with a machine with the exact same name as Windows Server 2012 R2-DC in my hypervisor console. I want to rename that guy to something that's not duplicate, obviously, and then off we go. Now, again, in the interest of time, I'm going to let this run.
Yep.
And I'll boot it, and I want to show you as it's booting that it's actually doing something. Because it's on a hypervisor that is VM Gen ID aware, it's going to realize that it has a new ID. It's going to realize that it basically was restored from a snapshot or that it was newly imported, and therefore it's going to pause doing anything with its domain controller directory services and instead dump it and start to use the information from the clone config domain controller.xml file that was created in one of the previous steps. So I'm going to go ahead and let this run. I'll let you know when it's done, and I'll simply jump back over here and show them that last little bit.
So using a clone is going to help speed up this process, because I don't know if any of you have run DC Promo on an old environment, but it can take quite a bit of time to have that run. And by the benefit of leveraging virtualization, we're able to very rapidly get our domain controllers out. It's the first step and probably one of the hardest steps inside of our infrastructure because that's such a core service. So by getting that in place and getting our core underlying directory environment updated, then we can start moving on to other things.
The big thing is that as soon as you go off with a newer version of Active Directory, you can take advantage of the what I call CYB, cover your butt, and
yes.
Turn on the ability of the Active Directory Recycle Bin.
Yeah. Recycle Bin is a huge reason for me to start at Active Directory. Now, DNS, it's pretty simple. If you're running Windows-based DNS, there's not a lot that you need to do. If you're running the older down-level ones that are not Active Directory integrated, then you're going to have to deal with exporting the DNS and moving it back in and leveraging these tools. Otherwise, it's just part. If it's part of Active Directory, it just moves with your domain controllers as we have here. Standalone DNS servers, as I mentioned, export the zone configuration, re-import it, update DHCP and anything else that you have there. We talked about migrating DHCP. If you want this, I see there's somebody taking photos of the slides, so the slides are available for download or will be shortly. You'll see that there are the steps for DHCP. Again, the process is the same. Leverage those tools. Get the migration tools installed. Go through it. Almost all the steps are the same on every service. Identify what it is. There's a couple of things based on a single service. So with this guy, you'll notice that the number of network cards inside of DHCP servers matter for this migration. Now, we do have a file server migration tool. One of the things that the file server migration tool can do is not only can it copy to that temporary storage location, as I mentioned before, but we can actually stream a connection from the source server to the destination server and stream the data with all of its SIDs and everything else. That is one of the pieces of this tool. That said, my counterpart here has some great information about file servers that came directly from the guys who build and write our file servers.
Yeah. And it's just rebooting right now and coming up for the very first time. Want to just show them that's coming up?
Yeah, we'll show you that domain controller coming back up.
The neat thing here is you'll actually see this guy come up and say, oh, starting cloned interface. And it takes a while to go through the interface that's over there. The big thing is that if you're using that streaming environment, that's great. There we go. So domain controller cloning is at 2%. It's going to sit at 5% for about 15 minutes or more. So we're not going to have a chance to finish this off and show you the finish of this. But I can definitely vouch for the fact that it did come up all the way, and it did act as a second domain controller called DC02 that had an IP address of .41 at the end of this. So I just wanted to show you what it looks like on the screen in a virtual world, much faster than doing this manually. So the file streaming technology is single-threaded. So you've got one thread copying and streaming the files between the old file server and the new file server. It's not terribly scalable. They actually recommend that you use the SMIG server migration tools to migrate the groups.
And so I'm only moving the groups?
Only the groups. And okay. You use good old-fashioned robocopy with a multi-threaded 16 multi-threads or 28 multi-threads, whatever it happens to be, to take full advantage of a multi-threaded copy much, much faster than using the stream information. Likewise as well, if you're using a very large amount of data that you're migrating between them, it has been known that that particular streaming technology will lock up, and there's no recourse to be able to fix it. So if you do a robocopy slash question mark, you'll be able to see, generally it's slash copy, full colon, and then you choose security attributes, directory and file folder level attributes, ownership of the files, auditing information as well. It has all the same switches as you would expect it needs to be able to do this. So long as you migrate the groups first, you will be able to use RoboCopy much, much faster to be able to do the move.
The other great thing is that RoboCopy has a restartable mode.
Yeah.
So you can go through and you can restart it. You can also, if you may have users using files and files may be locked during the copy if you didn't get a chance to completely lock everybody out. Rick did a file server migration a couple weeks ago.
I don't want to talk about it.
inside. And again, it was one of these projects we had to figure out. We've got a whole ton of data. How much of it is actually being used? How much of it are we going to migrate? And then, of course, even though Rick sent out the email, our admin sent out the email with the big red letters that say, as of this time, this file is not going to be available. Users were still using the files.
They came by really quickly when all of a sudden the server was turned off on the Saturday. All I did was unplug it. And I sent them all information about the new share and the new name. And if I was done, I would have actually migrated the computer name as well. But yeah, I don't want to talk. It was 12 terabytes of data I was migrating.
You can also use these tools if you're leveraging DFS to move the DFS namespace. It's a simple way to move that DFS namespace.
Yeah, you're basically just going to move in a new DFS name server into the existing space, let it replicate, and then get rid of the old DFS replication servers so that only the new ones are being used, and then slowly let them go.
Anybody still using DFS? Yeah? Great. Oh, print servers.
Ugh.
Anybody have that reaction with print servers?
Ugh.
Yeah, we've all dealt with them.
For this one here, it's really just the print server migration tool. You don't use the migration tools for PowerShell. And the worst part about it is trying to find the proper drivers to work on those print servers and being able to add them in. Again, you can take a look at some of the sessions we had done over the last 7 years to see us go ahead and do this. But Multifunction printers have a special soft spot in my heart, to say it nicely, for just how terrible they were to migrate. Yeah, it's just nasty.
So we've done this session at every Tech Ed for about the last 5 or 6 years, so you can go back and look for one or both of us, or one or the other, depending on which one of us happened to be here at the time, and we actually go through these. Sorry? So does the print server migration work from a 32 to a 64-bit environment? Big caveat at the top of the screen. Do you have the drivers?
The big thing is the drivers. Basically, you have to recreate the migration tools, and you have to have the 64-bit drivers and uncheck the 32-bit drivers if they're not being used. In the demo that I did, I had both 32-bit and 64-bit drivers in use.
And you can leverage the 32-bit drivers as well. So, yes. Yep. Again, going back to my earlier point, 32-bit works on 64-bit systems, right? The driver decision is going to be based on what your end systems are leveraging, unless your servers are printing too, right? All right.
Got about 5 minutes left here.
I've lost control. I've lost control. All right, web applications. up front, he just ducked down. He's like, no! I mentioned that in this environment, we had an IIS environment on top of SQL. There are a couple of different ways of doing this migration. Now, we love cooking shows when we're trying to consolidate what used to be and what we previously run as three separate sessions to do all of this into one. So Rick actually, unbeknownst to me, moved my web server and my database server, and he actually just moved it to a virtual machine, which is fine. But what he did is, because we've connected this infrastructure back up into Windows Azure, is he moved it directly into Windows Azure as a virtual machine. Because inside of Azure, we can very quickly run up a 2012 domain controller with SQL Server. And then we can very quickly run up server 2012 server with SQL Server. And then we ran up another 2012 box and installed IIS on it, and the two are talking to each other. And that's fine. You can still run them as infrastructure services. But let's be honest here. That's too much work. Why? Because we still have to manage and maintain that underlying operating system there. Inside of Microsoft Azure, what we have is we have the ability to run Azure websites and SQL Azure. And you can very easily move these applications to Azure websites and SQL Azure. And the benefit that we get from that is we're not managing a VM. We're no longer responsible for patching the underlying operating system, and no longer responsible for managing that, because those are platform as a service offerings. And new to the family of Microsoft tools is a, and I'm going to open this guy up and move him over here so that we can see, is the Windows Azure Migration Assistant. This is brand new. There is a prerequisite that it needs to have the WebPI tool installed on this. If you were doing this on a 2003 box, from my experience, install the Web Platform Installer first, because this tool, though it notices that you need WebPI, it doesn't get the down-level version that when you run just the default standalone Web Platform Installer, and you can just do a search Web Platform Installer. Just install the Web Platform Installer. When it comes up with all the things like PowerShell and everything, just exit there. And then you can run this. So you'll see that we are going to migrate using a dedicated IIS server. They're actually going to continue to expand this tool. But right now we've got a dedicated IIS tool. You'll see that you want to install this assistant tool. So if I click Install Tool, it's going to go ahead and it's going to do a run once piece. And it's going to go ahead and validate that we have the prerequisites. As I mentioned, in the interest of time, and we're running up against it, I've already installed the map tool. I've already done it. On average, on a 2003 machine, it takes about 5 minutes. So we're not talking a ton of time here to get all of that done. So now what we can do is we can choose to migrate the sites and the database on the local server to Azure, or we can do it remotely. And I've done both and had similar experiences. The way that this wizard works is identical, with the exception of putting in the username and password and the location of where those files are. So what this is going to do is it's going to go through and it's going to evaluate the IIS server that's running on this box. This box is already running. As I mentioned, it's a website that's got an IIS front end and a SQL Server back end. It's the default website because that's how we put everything in. Now, if I click next, what you're going to see is you're going to see a readiness report. This is a detail of everything that we're going to move and migrate. So you'll see that we've got a default IIS website. We don't have IIS 5 compatibility. That is the only caveat of using this tool. This tool will not move services running on IIS 5. IIS 6 is in 2003. Right? You'll see that any applications that we have here and any application pools, in this particular example, I'm using the default app pool. I'm using port 80 with a custom host name in this case, and you'll see that I have the AdventureWorks database. If I click upload, it's going to upload that readiness report, and it's going to run an assessment. And you'll notice that I get a warning here that I've got potential schema compliance issues because this is an ASP.NET application. Now, if I was to click view details on this, it's actually going to give us some mitigation. And you'll see IIS 7 schema compliance that there's an element or an attribute that's being used is not defined in Azure websites. However, I can create an XML file to allow that to occur. Now, in this case, that potential call, because I've actually tested it and worked with it, that potential call is not a concern for me. The app works fine without it. It's legacy code because this demonstration database and web server that I'm using came out in 2004. So it's old, it's legacy, we're not using it anymore, it's not a problem. It's just it's a piece within the ASP.NET. If I move that back down, I click begin migration, and I'm going to get options to connect into my Azure. Once I connect into Azure, it's going to say, do I want to create an Azure website? Do I want to create a database? And we're running up against it. Azure. Yeah, we're going over. But basically be able to go in and I can actually give it my credentials. I can tell it exactly what region I want to deploy this into. And then I can have it create its own Azure website, or I can have it create its own server, or I can give it the server names. I click migration. It takes about 25 minutes to actually create the services. Once those services are created, the last thing it does is copy all of the data from the IIS server up into that workload. So one simple tool to move, my friend in the front who went, one simple tool to do all of that. So with that, very quickly, we talked about the benefits of upgrading. We talked about all of the things that we need to take advantage of. When we're talking about third-party applications, I mentioned before, we cover the underlying infrastructure with our applications, and I have the deck available. With our applications, the responsibility for the applications from third parties it falls on the third-party application vendor. Or if it's an internal application, you're going to have to mitigate that application as well. There are shims and some of the other things like we had in the XP applications that allow those to run. But if the vendor has a new version of the application and their older versions are not supported on newer OSs, it's upgrade time. That's just the reality of it. We have to upgrade those. If you have run across a vendor of a third-party application that does not have a version that runs on a more modern platform, we have an ISV upgrade program. You can email us, isvupgrade@microsoft.com, or please come talk to me and let me know, because I've not found one yet. So if you have one that's still in business that does not have a newer version, let us know and we can help them get to a newer version to help you get off of Server 2003 and start proceeding into the next generation of operating systems. With that, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate you being here, and we hope you have a great rest of your conference. Thank you.